Chapter 19. Awakening. Matt opened his eyes slowly and stared up at the white plaster ceiling, wondering where he was and how he had come there. An intricate fringe of gilded leaves bordered the ceiling, and the mattress under his back felt plumped full of feathers. Somewhere rich, then. Somewhere with money. But his head was empty of the where and the how, and a lot more besides. He had been dreaming, and bits of those dreams still tumbled together with memories in his head. He could not separate one from the other. Wild flights and fights, strange people from across the ocean, ways and portal stones and pieces of other lives, things right out of a gleeman's tales. These had to be dreams. At least he thought they must be. But Loyal was no dream, and he was an Ogier. Chunks of conversation drifted around in his thoughts, talks with his father, with friends, with Moraine, and a beautiful woman, and a ship captain, and a well-dressed man who spoke to him like a father giving sage advice. Those were probably real. But it was all bits and fragments, drifting.
Muadrin tia dar alende kabadrin radiem, he murmured.
The words were only sounds, yet they sparked something. The packed lines of spearmen stretched a mile or more to either side below him, dotted with the pennants and banners of towns and cities and minor houses. The river secured his flank on the left, the bogs and mires on the right. From the hillside he watched the spearmen struggle against the mass of Trollocs trying to break through, 10 times the human's number. Spears pierced black Trolloc mail, and spiked axes carved bloody gaps in the human ranks. Screams and bellows harried the air. The sun burned hot overhead in a cloudless sky, and shimmers of heat rose above the battle line. Arrows still rained down from the enemy, slaying Trolloc and human alike. He had called his archers back, but the Dreadlords did not care so long as they broke his line. On the ridge behind him, the Heart Guard awaited his command, horses stamping impatiently. Armor on men and horses alike shone silver in the sunlight. Neither men nor animals could stand the heat much longer. They must win here or die. He was known as a gambler. It was time to toss the dice. In a voice that carried over the tumult below, he gave the order as he swung up into his saddle.
Footmen, prepare to pass cavalry forward!
His bannermen rode close beside him, the red eagle banner flapping over his head as the command was repeated up and down the line. Below, the spearmen suddenly moved, sidestepping with good discipline, narrowing their formations, opening wide gaps between. Gaps into which the Trollocs poured, roaring bestial cries like a black oozing tide of death. He drew his sword, raised it high.
Forward the Heart Guard!
He dug his heels in, and his mount leaped down the slope. Behind him, hooves thundered in the charge.
Forward!
He was first to strike into the Trollocs, his sword rising and falling, his bannermen close behind.
For the honor of the Red Eagle!
The Heart Guard pounded into the gaps between the spearmen, smashing the tide, hurling it back.
The Red Eagle!
Half-human faces snarled at him. Oddly curved swords sought him, but he cut his way ever deeper. Win or die.
Manetherin!
Matt's hand trembled as he raised it to his forehead.
Los Valda Quebiare, he muttered.
He was almost sure he knew what it meant. Forward the Heart Guard. Or maybe the Heart Guard will advance. But that could not be. Moraine had told him a few words of the old tongue, and those were all he knew of it. The rest might as well be magpie chatter.
Crazy, he said roughly. It probably isn't even the old tongue at all. Just gibberish. That Aes Sedai is crazy. It was only a dream.
Aes Sedai. Moraine. He suddenly became aware of his too thin wrist and bony hand, and looked at them. He had been sick. Something to do with a dagger. A dagger with a ruby in the hilt and a long-dead tainted city called Shadar Logoth. It was all foggy and distant and made no real sense,
but he knew it was no dream. Egwene and Nynaeve had been taking him to Tar Valon to be healed. He remembered that much. He tried to sit up and fell back, as weak as a newborn lamb. Laboriously, he pulled himself up and shoved the single woolen blanket aside. His clothes were gone, perhaps in the vine-carved wardrobe standing against the wall. For the moment, he did not care about clothes. He struggled to his feet, tottered across the flowered carpet to cling to a high-backed armchair, and lurched from the chair to the table, gilded scrolls on its legs and edges. Beeswax candles, four to each tall stand, and small mirrors behind the flames, lit the room brightly. A larger mirror on the wall above the highly polished washstand threw his reflection back at him, gaunt and wasted, cheeks hollow and dark eyes sunken, hair sweat-matted, bent like an old man and wavering like pasture grass in a breeze. He made himself stand straight, but it was not much improvement. A large covered tray sat on the table in front of his hands, and his nose caught the smells of food. He twitched aside the cloth, revealing two large silver pitchers and dishes of thin green porcelain. He had heard that the sea folk charged its weight in silver for that porcelain. He had expected beef tea or sweetbreads, the kinds of things invalids had pushed on them. Instead, one plate held slices of a beef roast, piled thickly, with brown mustard and horseradish. On others, there were roasted potatoes, sweet beans with onions, cabbage, and butter peas. Pickles and a wedge of yellow cheese. Thick slices of crusty bread and a dish of butter. One pitcher was filled with milk and still beaded with condensation on the outside. The other with what smelled like spiced wine. There was enough of everything for four men. His mouth watered and his stomach growled at him. First, I find out where I am. But he rolled up a slice of beef and dipped it in the mustard before pushing himself away from the table toward the three tall, narrow windows. Wooden shutters carved in lacy patterns covered them, but through the holes he could see that it was night outside. Lights from other windows made dots in the blackness. For a moment he sagged against the white stone windowsill in frustration, but then he began to think. You can turn the worst that comes to your advantage if you only think, his father always said. And certainly Abel Cawthon was the best horse trader in the Two Rivers. When it seemed somebody had taken advantage of Matt's father, it always turned out they had gotten the greasy end of the stick. Not that Abel Cawthon ever did anything dishonest, but even Tarin Ferry folk never got the best of him, and everybody knew how close to the bone they cut. All because he thought about things from every side that there was. Tar Valon. It had to be Tar Valon. This room belonged in a palace. The flowered Damani carpet alone probably cost as much as a farm. More, he did not think he was sick any longer, and from what he had been told, Tar Valon was his only chance to get well. He had never actually felt sick, not that he remembered, not even when Varen, another name, swam out of the haze, had told someone nearby that he was dying. Now he felt weak as a babe and hungry as a starving wolf, but somehow he was sure the healing had been done. I feel well and whole. That's all. I've been healed. He grimaced at the shutters. Healed. That meant they had used the one power on him. The notion sent goosebumps marching across his skin, but he had known it would be done. Better than dying, he told himself. Some of the stories he had heard about Aes Sedai came back. It has to be better than dying. Even Nynaeve thought I was going to die. Anyway, it's done, and worrying about it now won't help anything. He realized he had finished the slice of beef and was licking its juice from his fingers. Unsteadily, he made his way back to the table. There was a stool underneath. He pulled it out and sat down. Not bothering with knife or fork, he made another roll of beef. How could he turn being in Tar Valon, in the White Tower, it has to be, to his advantage? Tar Valon meant Aes Sedai. That was certainly no reason to stay, even an hour. Exactly the opposite. What he remembered of his time with Moraine, and later with Varen, was not much to go on. He could not recall either of them doing anything really terrible, but then he could not recall a great deal of that time at all. Anyway, whatever Aes Sedai did, they did for their own reasons. "And those aren't always the reasons you think they are," he mumbled around a mouthful of potato, then swallowed. "An Aes Sedai never lies, but the truth an Aes Sedai tells you isn't always the truth you think it is. That's one thing I have to remember. I can't be sure about them, even when I think I know." It was not a cheering conclusion. He filled his mouth with butter peas. Thinking about Aes Sedai made him remember a little about them. There were 7 Ajahs. Blue, red, brown, green, yellow, white, and gray. The reds were the worst, except for that black Ajah they all claim doesn't exist. But the red Ajah should be no threat to him. They were only interested in men who could channel.
Rand. Burn me, how could I forget that? Where is he? Is he all right?
He sighed regretfully and spread butter on a piece of still warm bread.
I wonder if he's gone mad yet.
Even if he knew the answers, he could do nothing to help Rand. He was not sure he would if he could. Rand could channel, and Matt had grown up with stories of men channeling, stories to frighten children. Stories that frightened adults, too, because some of them were all too true. Discovering what Rand could do had been like finding out his best friend tortured small animals and killed babies. Once you finally made yourself believe it, it was hard to call him a friend any longer.
"I have to look out for myself," he said angrily.
He upended the wine pitcher over his silver cup and was surprised to find it empty. He filled the cup with milk instead.
"Egwene and Nynaeve want to be Aes Sedai."
He had not really remembered that until he said it aloud.
"Rand is following Moraine around and calling himself the Dragon Reborn. The Light knows what Perrin is up to. He's been acting crazy ever since his eyes turned funny. I have to look out for myself." "Burn me, I have to. I'm the last one of us who's still sane. There's only me."
Tar Valon. Well, it was supposed to be the wealthiest city in the world, and it was the center of trade between the Borderlands and the South, the center of Aes Sedai power. He did not think he could get an Aes Sedai to gamble with him, or trust the fall of the dice or the turn of the cards if he did. But there had to be merchants and others with silver and gold. The city itself would be worth a few days. He knew he had traveled far since leaving the Two Rivers, but aside from a few vague memories of Camelin and Kyrian, he could remember nothing of any great cities. He had always wanted to see a great city.
"But not one full of Aes Sedai," he muttered sourly, scraping up the last of the butter peas.
He gulped them down and went back for another helping of beef. Idly, he wondered if the Aes Sedai might let him have the ruby from the Shadar Logoth dagger. He remembered the dagger in only the fuzziest way, but even that was like remembering a terrible injury. His insides knotted up and sharp pain dug at his temples. Yet the ruby was clear in his mind, as big as his thumbnail, dark as a drop of blood, glittering like some crimson eye. Surely he had more claim to it than they did, and it had to be worth as much as 12 farms back home.
"They'll probably say it is tainted, too."
And likely it was. Still, he spun a little fancy of trading the ruby to some of the Coplins for their best land. Most of that family, troublemakers from the cradle, where they were not thieves and liars as well, deserved whatever happened to them and more. But he really did not believe the Aes Sedai would give it back to him, did not relish the notion of carrying it as far as Emmons Field if they did. And the thought of owning the largest farm in the Two Rivers was no longer as exciting as it once had been. Once that had been his biggest ambition, that and to be known as his father's equal as a horse trader. Now it seemed such a small thing to want, a cramped thing, with the whole wide world just waiting out there. First off, he decided, he would find Egwene and Nynaeve.
Maybe they've come to their senses. Maybe they've given up this foolishness about becoming Aes Sedai.
He did not think they would have, but he could not go without seeing them. He would go, that was sure.
A visit with them, a day to see the city, perhaps a game with the dice to pad out his purse, and then he would be off for somewhere where there were no Aes Sedai. Before he returned home, "I will go home one day. One day I will." He meant to see something of the world, and without any Aes Sedai making him dance to her tune. Rummaging around the tray for something more to eat, he was shocked to realize nothing was left but smears and a few crumbs of bread and cheese. The pitchers were both empty. He squinted down at his stomach in wonder. He should have been stuffed to the ears with all that in him, but he felt as if he had hardly eaten at all. He scraped the last bits of cheese together between thumb and forefinger. Halfway to his mouth, his hand froze. "I blew the horn of Elir." Softly, he whistled a bit of tune, then cut it short when the words came to him. "I'm down at the bottom of the well. It's night and the rain is coming down. The sides are falling in, and there's no rope to climb. I'm down at the bottom of the well." "There had better be a bloody rope to climb," he whispered. He let the cheese crumbs fall on the tray. For the moment, he felt sick again. Determinedly, he tried to think, tried to penetrate the fog that shrouded everything in his head. Varen had been bringing the horn to Tar Valon, but he could not remember if she knew he was the one who had blown it. She had never said anything to make him think so. He was sure of that. He thought he was. So what if she does know? What if they all do? Unless Varen did something with it I don't know about, they have the horn. They don't need me. But who could say what Aes Sedai thought they needed? "If they ask," he said grimly, "I never even touched it. If they know, I'll handle that when it comes. Burn me, they can't want anything from me. They can't." A soft knock on the door brought him swaying to his feet, ready to run. If there had been any place to run to, and if he could have managed more than 3 steps. But there was not, and he could not. The door opened.